We left off last time by Perek Aleph and Malachim Beis, Pasuk Ches. We finished off the story had been that Ahav's son was king. He was the king. Ahaziah was king at the end of Malachim Aleph, and we read about him last week in the beginning of Malachim Beis, that he's king, and he had this unfortunate accident where he basically felt that he was on perhaps his deathbed, and he wanted to know whether or not he was going to live, whether or not he was going to die, and he made the awful decision of sending messengers to a foreign god, the Baal Zavuv, who was the god of the city of Ekron, one of the cities of the Plishtim, and Eliyahu intercepted those messengers and, you know, asked the fateful question, are there no gods, is there no god in Israel that you have to go to a foreign nation? And Eliyahu said, you have to go back to Ahaziah and tell him this message. And they go back, and Ahaziah hears the message. The message is the prophecy that he's going to go up on the bed that he's gone up onto. He's going to not get off of. He's going to die. And the way that the messengers had described him was, they described Eliyahu. Eliyahu was the Navi. They described him. Ahaziah asked, what does he look like? And they gave this description in Pasuk Ches. And after the description, this was our last thoughts of last week, all of a sudden, Ahaziah came to the realization, Elia Hatishbi. Oh, you just described the way they gave this weird description, how he had a lot of hair, and how he had this certain belt. And he already knew that this means that it is... That it is none other than Eliyahu HaNavi. So here, Eliyahu HaNavi is not yet on the actual scene. And we had discussed a little bit last time why it is that Eliyahu was not coming into the palace. And we said the basic approach of the Lama Mefarshim is that Eliyahu was afraid. Izebel was still alive. Izebel is now queen mother, as opposed to being the wife of Ahav. Now she's just the mother of Ahaziah, but she's still extremely powerful. And her relationship with Eliyahu was nothing positive. And unless he's going to have a tzivoy, unless he's going to have a commandment from Hashem to go, he doesn't want to put himself into that situation. And we'll see, we're going to get to in a couple of psukim, he does finally receive a commandment from Hashem to go before Ahaziah. So here is the reaction of Ahaziah to realizing that it's Eliyahu. And you have to imagine that Ahaziah knows the family history. He knows that Eliyahu was not exactly the best prophet for his father, Ahav. And so in Pasuk Tes, Vayishlach Elov is Ahaziah sending towards Eliyahu. Sar Chamishim, an officer who was in charge of 50 soldiers, V'chamishav, and this officer's unit of 50 soldiers. So a commanding officer and 50 soldiers, which sounds almost to the simple level of pshat, it sounds like he wants to get Eliyahu, and he's sending this as his brute force. Vayal Elov. Well, it could have, meaning Sar Chamishim just means that's his title. His title, you know, that's the equivalent of, let's say, a major or a colonel. That's his title is Sar Chamishim. So if it just said Sar Chamishim, it could be he's sending one officer to go get. But here the officer brings his entourage of the 50. Okay, you might have said that maybe you would have thought that on your own. Vayal Elov, so the officer comes up to Eliyahu. And we're going to see that Eliyahu, Vihine Yoshev al Rosh Ahar. Eliyahu was situated on top of a mountain, on top of a hill, and the officer approached him and came all the way up, for our purposes perhaps to be eye level, or face to face with Eliyahu. Vayidaber Elov, and this officer speaks to Eliyahu, Ish Elokim, man of God, Hamelech Diber Reda. The Melech has spoken, come down, come with us. And it seems to be very lacking respect. Here you have Eliyahu situated on top, and this officer doesn't first call out to him, doesn't first ask, you know, can we have a conversation? But immediately comes to be eye level, immediately runs up and speaks to him in a very, it seems to, I mean, I read it harshly, because I think it is harsh, and that's the way the Mefarshim understand it. Just saying, Ish Elokim, HaMelech Diber Rida. Very short, very curt. Oh, man of God, almost, you would say, it doesn't sound to be so respectful. The king says, come down. And we're going to see this tension, that the overall tension throughout the Perek is what the Melech wants and what the Ish Elokim and what Hashem wants. And there seems to be this tension back and forth, and we see who wins out in the end. You could, you know, place your bets. The fact that he calls him an Ish Elokim, so what does it mean you're an Ish Elokim? If you're referring to him as an Ish Elokim, and you mean what you're saying, then you should be treating the person with a little more respect than you're treating him. The fact that he treats him with such short amount of words, and it seems to be without respect, shows that that then reveals to us that when he says Ish Elokim, he's not meaning it sincerely. He's meaning it flippantly. Oh yeah, you're a man of God. You have to remember, in the household of Ahaziah, continuing in the ways of his father, there are many gods. Just because you're from the Jewish God, you're from Hashem, that doesn't have weight in the Ahaziah's house. And so it's even the title Ish Elokim, which we always hold to be holy, seems to be being used in a very derogatory, relatively derogatory manner. Pasuk Yud. Vayana Eliyahu. So Eliyahu answers back to this Sar Hamisha. Vayidaber El Sar Hamisha. And he speaks to the officer of the 50. The Im Ish Elokim Ani, if it's true that I am a man of God, Teirid Eish Min Hashamayim, a fire should come down from heaven, V'sochal Oscha V'es Hamishecha, and the fire should consume you and your 50 soldiers. V'Teirid Eish Min Hashamayim, and lo and behold, fire comes down from heaven, V'tochal Oso V'es Hamishav, and consumes all 51 individuals, are punished by death. This is the same Eliyahu who stood at Har HaKarmel. And if you can, and what Eliyahu did at Har HaKarmel, showing what it means to be a representative of Hashem, is that if you're going to respect Hashem, then you're not going to talk to the Ish Elokim that way. And you're not going to place the king, who's only a human king, Ahaziah, above the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Here, all Mefarshim seem to say that Eliyahu made this decision on his own. We had discussed when it came to the episode of Har HaKarmel that there was a debate. That did Eliyahu kind of come up with the idea on his own and Hashem listened, or was it something that Hashem had told him before? Here it seems that everyone agrees that Eliyahu came up with this idea by himself, and Hashem agrees. The fact that it happens, Eliyahu doesn't have the power to bring fire down from Shamayim, to perform such a miracle, it has to be that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives his haskama, but that this was considered to be an affront on the Navi of Hashem. And again, you have to take it in the context of what was happening. The Chil Hashem here of a Melech in Yisrael taking his Avodah Zara tendency and airing it out in front of other countries, and by sending messengers to the Plishti to go ahead and ask advice from a foreign Avodah Zarah, that's almost doing something that Achav never did. That Achav, as evil as he was, he kept the Avodah Zarah in-house. He kept it amongst fellow Israelites. And that's bad. But to go ahead and extend it outside and to advertise that the Melech Yisrael, who everyone knows the Jews had a God, when the Aron was taken by the Plishtim in Sefer Shmuel, and they were struck with a punishment of hemorrhoids, they immediately said, it's the God of the Jews. So they wanted to move the Aron to another location. Maybe the God doesn't have power. They don't necessarily believe in Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, but they believe in Hashem. That's the God of the Jews. And the Avodah Zarah society, they have their God, we have our God. So the offense, and this is all coming off of that. So you might be thinking to yourself, this punishment seems quite harsh. It's in the context of an Avodah Zarah culture, that which is really an affront to Hashem and to Eliyahu, who's just a representative of Hashem. And so the message should have been very clear to Ahaziah that the ball is not in your court, and we're not dealing with this, Eliyahu, and you are not going to have dialogue on your terms. But Ahaziah is stubborn. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayashav. He repeats. Does it again. Vayishlach Elav Sar Chamishim Acher V'Chamishav. He sends another officer of 50 with his 50 soldiers. Vayan, and this captain spoke up, answered. Vayidaber Elav, and spoke to Eliyahu. Some point out that at this point, it seems he didn't go up to his level. Rather, he stayed low. Ish Elokim, man of God. Ko Amar HaMelech, Mehera Reda. Come down quickly. And so the Mefarshim are kind of torn. I didn't see anyone say the same thought. So one approach said that the fact that he didn't go up to his level shows that he was having this officer was having a little more respect. But if you take a look at the end of the pasuk, he seems to be even more chutzpahdik. He doesn't just say come down. He says mehera, come quickly. And you're right, Eliyahu. We're never, if I'm not mistaken, we're never really told the age of Eliyahu. And next parak Beis is going to be the famous parak of Eliyahu leaving this world, and how he leaves this world we'll have to talk about. But you can imagine he's not a young person, so it's very disrespectful to say mehera reda. And so some people think that this second officer was actually even more chutzpahdik than the first. In the back of your mind, you have to be asking yourself the question that if Ahaziah was healthy and wanted to have a dialogue with Eliyahu, knowing that the first group of soldiers met such a death, would he have been so quick to himself come and approach Eliyahu in such a disrespectful manner? Or it's easy when you're sitting up in your, I mean, he wasn't in a good place because he was ill, but it's easy when you're in the palace to go ahead and send soldiers to do your bidding. Plus a good base. Vayan Eliyahu answers, Vayidaber Aleihem, and he speaks to them. Im ish ha'elokim ani, if it's really true that I am an ish ha'elokim, that I am a man of God, teirid esh min ha'shamayim, v'sochol oscha v'es chamishecha, then a fire should come down from heaven and should consume you and your 50 soldiers, v'teirid esh elokim min ha'shamayim, and lo and behold, the fire comes again, v'tochol oso v'es chamishav, and again, the fire consumes the officer and his 50 soldiers. Two times the same exact thing. And yet one has to imagine that word gets back to Ahaziah. Now, we've discussed before that the Navi doesn't always tell us everything that happened. The Navi tells us certain pieces of information. We're left to think what was the reaction of those soldiers and the officer when Eliyahu said, well, you know, if I really am a man of God, I this is going to happen to you. So some wanted to theorize that it must be that even with that, they acted brazenly. And they didn't immediately say, we're sorry. They didn't immediately say, you're right. They didn't immediately take sides. That they remained brazen, and so the punishment actually came. So here is Ahaziah sitting there in his palace, in his lying ill on a bed. He sent one group, punishment, miracle, pro Eliyahu, against him. Sends a second group, same exact thing. So what do you do if you're a stubborn? If you're a stubborn Ovid of Avodah Zarah, you send a third group. You send the third group again. It's not you. No sweat off your back. It's just. It's hard for us to, you shouldn't say that, but from his perspective, it's just soldiers. He seems to have enough of them. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayashav, he returns again, repeats. Vayishlach sar chamishim shlishim v'chamishav. He sends his third officer of the 50 with the 50 soldiers. Vayal, and this captain comes up. Vayavo sar hachamishim hashlishi. And when he arrives, this officer of the 50 arrives, Vayichra al Birkov, he immediately bends down on his knees. Leneged Eliyahu, facing Eliyahu. Vayischanein Elav, and he entreats Eliyahu. Vayidaber Elav, and he speaks to him. Ish Elokim, man of God. Tikar na nafshi. Let my soul have yikar. Let my soul have value. Let my soul be precious. Namely, save my life. Spare my life. V'nefesh avadecha eila chamishim be'inecha. And the life of your servants, these 50 soldiers, in your eyes, it should be tikar. It should be precious. It should be yikar. One has to imagine that this captain is now going AWOL. This captain is walking on this mission and thinking over in his head that this is ridiculous. I have this crazy king, and I have an Ish Elokim. And the last two who made the decision to argue and be disrespectful to Ish Elokim met their death. I'd have to be crazy. And so, right, because we never receive, all it said, the Pasuk is very clear. From Ahaziah's perspective, it just says Vayashav Bishlishas, meaning he sent it a third time. He wanted the mission to go again. And according to most Mefarshim, Ahaziah wanted to get Eliyahu, wanted to capture him and deal with him for saying such a negative prophecy. We had discussed the theory, maybe if you kill him, then you kill his prophecy to some, you know, you lessen the blow. People will think, oh, if you killed him, the prophecy must have evaporated as well. So the king hasn't changed. So this captain makes a decision on his own that it's better for me to align myself with the Ish Elokim than with the king. And he's probably doing a cost-benefit analysis. The worst thing that could happen for him if he goes against the king is to be killed. But if he goes against the Ish Elokim, he's definitely going to be killed. So yeah, maybe he was a real Lamdan, and he knew that if you have a suffik and a vadai, you have a doubt and a surety, you're supposed to side with the surety. So this is... If he goes against Eliyahu, he's definitely going to die. And so he puts himself into Eliyahu's mercy. And he continues, and he recognizes who Eliyahu is. Pasuk Yudalad. Hine yarda esh min hashamayim. Behold, a fire came down from heaven. Vatochel eshnei sare hachamishim harishonim ve'es chamishehem. And this fire consumed the first two captains. And all of their divisions of 50, the ata, and now tikar nafshi be'enecha, may my soul be worthy in your eyes. Can you save us? Can you have mercy on us? So the truth is that you ask yourself the question. I just thought of this right now. On the one hand, it's not really Eliyahu. On the other hand, if all you're going to do is, if what you're going to do is not necessarily listen to the king, so why didn't he just, I don't know, just take off and go another direction? It seems he wants the best of both worlds. He wants to find a middle ground. This officer must want to try to find a middle ground where he can complete his mission and have Eliyahu come to the palace, but not get killed in the process of conversing with Eliyahu. And so he immediately goes into mercy mode. He immediately asks for the Rachmanus. But the fact that he's still talking to Eliyahu means he still wants to accomplish his mission. If all he wants to do is to save himself, so run away. You know, run away from your mission. Pull a Yonah. Take your men and run away. Maybe run to the people of Yehuda. Maybe they'll take you in and you could, you know, just... But the fact that he's talking to Eliyahu means he wants to still... complete his mission. His mission is to bring Eliyahu. But does it say that he said, right? No, he never. He didn't ask. But what is he talking to? He's not. Why else would he be talking to Eliyahu? He's not coming just to make friends. He's coming to accomplish the mission, but he doesn't know how to do it. So Eliyahu, at this point, you have to imagine that Eliyahu can make the following decision. Eliyahu can decide, I'll have mercy on them because they were not disrespectful. They did it the right. They came to me the right way, falling on their knees, asking for mercy. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go with them, because so far we're going with the most Rishonim say that the Eliyahu was nervous for his life. Even Eliyahu doesn't want to rely on miracles. He doesn't want to go into Ahaziah's house unless Hashem tells him to go to the house. Till now, that hasn't happened. So right at this juncture, you have to imagine that Eliyahu is ready to have mercy. He was a merciful person. But he's not ready to go along with them. So it comes, Pasuk Tesvav. Vayidaber Malach Hashem El Eliyahu. The angel of Hashem, a Malach, comes and speaks to Eliyahu. Reid Oso. Now the Malach says, go down with him, meaning with this captain. Al tira mipanav, and do not fear him. Presumably, fear him is not only the captain, but fear him is Ahaziah. Don't be afraid. Once he hears it from the Malach, once he hears it from Hashem, Vayakam Eliyahu gets up, Vayered Oso al HaMelech, and they bring him, he goes down with him to the king. Pasuk Tazayin. And first, so it seems this captain was successful. He pulled it off. Pasuk Tazayin. Vayidaber Elav. And Eliyahu spoke to him. Eliyahu spoke to Ahaziah. Ko amar Hashem, so has said Hashem. Ya'an asher shalachta malachim lidrosh b'bal zvuv Elohei Ekron. Because you sent messengers to seek out and inquire of the Avodah Zarah Baal Zvuv, the gods of Ekron. Hamibli ein Elokim b'Yisrael, is there no God in Israel, Lidrosh b'Dvaro, to search out his word? Lachain hamita asher alita sham, therefore this bed that you have gone up upon, lo seired mimenu kimos tamus, you will not go down from it, you shall surely die. It's the exact repetition of the prophecy that Eliyahu had delivered to the messengers. And in some ways, the perek is a little anticlimactic in that there's no new information is here. Eliyahu just delivers the same prophecy that we had heard before, and we don't hear Ahaziah's reaction, we don't hear a whole uproar in the court. The story kind of ends. Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayamos kidvar Hashem asher diber Eliyahu. Ahaziah died according to the word of Hashem that was spoken through Eliyahu. Vayimloch Yehoram tachtav. His brother Yehoram ruled in his place. Bishnas shtayim liYehoram ben Yehoshaphat melech Yehuda, which was in the second year of a similar name, Yehoram, same name, Yehoram, the son of Yehoshaphat, who was the king of Yehuda, kilo hayalo bein, because our Ahaziah had no children. And so this is the first time since we started learning Sefer Malachim and Sefer Shmuel. It's the first time that we have the monarch, the king, not going to a son, but going to a brother. Meaning you're going back a generation, instead of going to the next generation, stay at that same level, another son of Achav. We'll read the last pasuk we'll come back just to finish it. Pasuk Yudches. V'yeser divrei Ahaziyahu, the other happenings of Ahaziah's time, asher asa, that he accomplished, halohem ksuvim, they're written, Al Sefer Divrei Hayamim Malchi Yisrael, in that book of Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, which we say basically is the ending pasuk for every king. Before we go back and make some observations on the whole story, if you were keeping track of the kings, you would all be jumping with a question. Because why? Because we were told that this Ahaziah, and we were told this just at the end of Malachim Aleph, we were told that Ahaziah, the son of Achav, became king in the 17th year of Yehoshaphat, and this Ahaziah only ruled for 2 years, which means he exits in Yehoshaphat's 19th year. Yehoshaphat was king for 25 years. That leaves about 6 years, which the Mefarshim say is really seven, because this 2 years was even less than 2 years. It was short. It was one of those king 2 years. And so it should be in this, in the 19th year of Yehoshaphat, that's when this other son of Ahav becomes king. So why is the pasuk presenting to us, no, that it was past the rule of Yehoshaphat, 2 years into Yehoshaphat's son, Yehoram? So that's the question. The question is a chronological question, and it bothers all the Mefarshim, and anyone who would be keeping track of the years, it would bother them as well. And so there are a number of approaches. The Radak explains in a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim that the sons of Yehoshaphat, who was the king in Yehuda, they had already in the lifetime of Yehoshaphat, there were succession fights. Which son is going to take over for Yehoshaphat? Something that we actually haven't seen up until this point. We saw it in the time of David, that some of his other sons wanted to take over for him, but his sons were so brazen that they were ready to start being king while David was still alive. That's kind of a different type. We call them rebellions. It wasn't just that they were rejecting. Avshalom was definitely a rebellion, and even Adoniah was rejecting Shlomo but he was doing it while David was still alive. We haven't really had much discussion about how did it work. Was it always the oldest son would become king automatically? You know, it's not clear. With David, it didn't work that way. If anything, it's one of his youngest sons. He goes on to have more children with Bathsheba, and who knows, at that point, maybe has more children with other wives. So we're not really told how this all works. We think, from our knowledge of secular kings, it usually seems to go to the oldest son. So the Radak explains that this fight is taking place, and so Yehoshaphat himself wanted to solve the fight and named his son Yehoram king while he was still king. And so it was kind of like they were like co-kings because of that. So the second year of Yehoram means it's the second year since he started being named as, you know, what's it called? The prince who's going to, the crown prince, right? The crown prince is the name of the prince who's supposed to take over. So Yehoram named him as a crown prince. Rashi here quotes from Seder Olam that because Yehoshaphat, a couple of prakim ago, sided with Ahav when they wanted to fight against Ramos Gilad and that fight against Aram, so that was a tremendous mistake that the king of Yehuda, that Yehoshaphat made, and Yehoshaphat deserved to die for such a mistake. But in the war, when the enemies thought that he was Ahav, and you remember he called out, and they heard his voice, and they recognized his voice, that it's not Ahav's voice, they left him alone, that call out was a call of tshuva, and so he was spared. But since he was deserving to be killed, he himself felt he was unfit to rule. And so while he was the quote-unquote official ruler, he had his son Yehoram take over the everyday activities of being king. Again, it's working out the numbers. If the numbers don't bother you, then it's not really such a problem. If it bothers you, then you have the Radak, and you have Rashi. There are a couple of insights to be made for the Perek as a whole, and two of them are a little similar. Something that we don't always do, but when we have the opportunity, it's interesting. The concept of a Mila Mancha, a guide word. In German, they call it a Leitwort. It's a literary technique where an author puts a word numerous times in a section to kind of give a thematic overview of the section. And it's something that exists within Tanakh. It exists we obviously believe that this is all from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave meaning to the Tanakh, and he gave meaning in terms of repetitious words. So the usual approach that many commentators talk about is that if a word repeats itself seven times in an area, that's significant as being a guide word, or sometimes in multiples of seven. So here, there are two separate, quote-unquote, guide words for this perek that add significance. The first, and you don't have to take your time right now, you can do it at home. If you go through the whole perek, you're going to see 21 times either the word going up or the word going down. Either oleh or yorad in different terms, and it seems to be overly used. Overly used of the word Alisa and Teirad, Yarad, Allah, overly used 21 times, because this whole perek is about the reign of Ahaziah, who he thinks he has on a very basic level, he thinks he has a chance of going up, but he's really coming down. And there's this tension between the Dvar HaMelech and the Ish Elokim. The Dvar HaMelech and the Dvar Hashem. And there's this up and down which is taking place. The other word which repeats itself something about 16 times is the word Daber. And it almost seems to be superfluous in many of the instances. If you go back to some of the Psukim that we just read, right, just for example, take a look at Pasuk Tes. Right, this was the first Pasuk we read tonight. Vayishlach elav sar chamishim v'chamisha vayal elav v'hine yosha al rosh ahar vayidaber elav ish elokim hamelech diber reda. Using both, again, a double language of the, then vayana Eliyahu vayidaber el sar chamishim. What vayana means? He's answering. If he's answering, so start talking. It's almost as if the pasuk is throwing us extra shorishes, extra roots of the word daber, vayidaber, davar, daber, diber, all the different types of permutations, because this whole parak it's about this tension between the word of the king. Oh, the king is asking you to come. The king is saying this. The king is making demands. But the other side of the equation is that this is not about the king. This is about the Dvar Hashem. This is about what Hashem wants, and that's going to be the seal. It's going to be the prophecy which is said both at the beginning and at the end. It's kind of like the bookends, right? It's Pasuk Gimel had the first prophecy, that the Malach came to Eliyahu and to send the message that. Is there no God in Israel that you can search out? And then that prophecy, again, we had said in a way it's anticlimactic. The prophecy is mentioned, it's literally word for word. It's almost like copy and paste, because that's the bookends of what's happening in this parak. This parak is bookended by a Dvar Hashem coming to counteract the Dvar HaMelech. You know, it's HaMelech, the capital Melech, HaMelech, against a human king, and it puts into proper perspective what it is that a king is supposed to be. A king, first and foremost, is supposed to be subservient to Hashem. And that, in Malchus Yisrael, that almost never happened. So far, it's strikeout after strikeout. But it's a fear that happens even with the kings of Yehuda. And it go, you know, we play in the back of your minds, you should be going back a little bit of Perek Ches of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, where when the people asked for a king, Shmuel and Hashem were so critical of asking for a king. There's a risk. There's a risk to having a human king and the power corrupting the king, that here you could have a king in a grotesque manner saying, it's my way that counts, and who cares about you, Ish Elokim? Who cares about what Hashem wants? And this, for our purpose, reading this, and why this story is highlighted is it's another instance of Klal Yisrael as a representative by the king they had making such an affront against Hashem, and Eliyahu being the one, time and time again, the one who comes to defend the honor of Hashem. And this is technically Eliyahu's last act on behalf of Hashem and therefore on behalf of Klal Yisrael. And it's indicative of the fact that Eliyahu was relentless in protecting the covet of Shemayim. And maybe sometimes he took it too far, And maybe sometimes, and we had the prophecy that took place when he was by Har Sinai, maybe we understood that Hashem being critical of him, being teased too harsh against Klal Yisrael. But Eliyahu always sided with protecting the honor of Hashem to the nth degree. And this parak really serves to that, really serves to that final act of Eliyahu, continuing that till literally the last day of his life, he's fighting the good fight against the Malchus Yisrael and against the Avodah Zarah culture, which here, perhaps, you know, we keep talking about it. You don't like believe me anymore because we keep talking about how it gets worse. But in a way, this was really because of the fact that he's going to a foreign entity, a foreign government, that was a little bit considered to be of a worse direction. I think that finishes our study of Perek Aleph, and we still have time, so we're going to start Perek Beis tonight. So I'll just hand out the copies of Perek Beis for those who need Perek Beis. And Perek Beis in Melachim Beis is going to be the final chapter of us dealing with Eliyahu, the way that we've been dealing with Eliyahu, and meaning in the context of his current life, and we're going to segue into an Eliyahu of a different life form, perhaps, and we have to discuss it, and we will. This parak also acts, and it should be in the back of your mind, it acts as a transition. The parak beis is a transition of the Navi, passing of Nevuah, of the seat of being a prophet, passing from Eliyahu to Elisha. And we haven't had too much interaction between Eliyahu and Elisha from the time that Elisha was chosen. We had this moment, a couple of psukim, very intense psukim of Eliyahu showing up out of nowhere, and this individual, Elisha ben Shaphat, he's working with the cattle in the field, and Eliyahu says, "Come, let's go right now." And Elisha says, "Wait, hold on, I have to go kiss my mother and my father." And he goes, and he ends up making this whole feast for the other workers and the people in the town. And then we don't really hear from Elisha again. And then in this parak, all of a sudden they're inseparable until HaKadosh Baruch Hu separates them in a final act of separation. And so there are a lot of bits and pieces that we kind of have to put together. The parak provides us with a heading to the parak, which isn't always common, but it's helpful. It gives away the most amazing thing that happens in the parak. And sometimes, you know, you're supposed to keep your best cards for the end of the hand, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu thought differently here. Pasuk Aleph, Vayihi Bahalos Hashem es Eliyahu. It happened when Hashem took Eliyahu up, Basa'ara Hashamayim, in a whirlwind to heaven. Vayelach Eliyahu ve'Elisha mina Gilgal. Eliyahu went with Elisha from Gilgal. So until you get, and here we have an example, we've talked about it before, that the way that we understand the sentences of Tanakh is through the cantillation notes, through the trup. And this is always an example, we've discussed it before, an example where the entire world believes in Torah Shabal Peh. The entire world believes in the oral Torah. Every non-Jewish Bible in the world believes in, for the Old Testament, believes in the Torah Shabal Peh, the oral Torah, because they all divide the verses the way that our tradition says to divide the verses. Nowadays, we have these nice printed books, but they used to only have scrolls. You open up the scrolls, there are no periods, there are no dots, there are no commas. How do you know where to start and stop? Okay, there are some spaces, so you could imagine that how do you start and stop a sentence? It's only with the Tarshu Baal Peh. The Tarshu Baal Peh says, where is a Sof Pasuk? The next word is the next sentence. And I don't believe there's a Bible in the world that breaks up the Old Testament differently than our Bible, than this Tanakh, right? You're not going to find a book of Kings that does it differently than our Tarshu Baal Peh. So that's already a proof, not that you're out there proving against those who don't believe in Tarshu Baal Peh, but it's something that we don't think about. We take it for granted. But it's Tarshu Baal Peh that tells us where the cantillation notes should be. So we know there's a Sof Pasuk, that's the end of a sentence. There's also an Asnachta. The word Asnachta, that's the upside down wishbone, or regular wishbone, that has the word Nach in it. What does the word Nach mean? To rest. And Asnachta is a pause. And so every Pasuk usually can be broken up at least into two kind of semi-clauses. The first clause will go until the Asnachta, and then the second clause will go from the Asnachta until the Sof Pasuk. So here, our heading, I said this opens with the heading ends at the Asnachta. Vayibalos Hashem es Eliyahu basara Hashamayim. It was when that happened, in the midst of that happening, something else happened. Vayelech Eliyahu ve'Elisha mina Gilgal. Eliyahu and Elisha went from Gilgal. And we're going to discuss that phrase of Eliyahu and Elisha going from Gilgal in and of itself. But it seems that the Pasuk is presenting, and this is going to be a little hard for us to understand or appreciate, that as great as the miracle of Eliyahu going up into heaven, that's not the act of significance of this perek, perhaps. The act of significance is the Elisha piece. The act of significance is that this is going to be a perek of transition. This is going to be a perek. Now, it's odd because how did Eliyahu come on the scene? Out of nowhere. Hashem didn't send Eliyahu. We don't know who Eliyahu was. All of a sudden, Eliyahu is telling Achav there's going to be no rain for 3 years. Out of nowhere. You know, Eliyahu wants to fight the good fight. He wants to fight for Kavod Shamayim. And because Achav had said brazenly, according to the Medrash, that if there's a God, where is my punishment? Because there was, if you recall, there was that person who built in the city of Yericho, and he was punished because Yehoshua gave a curse that anyone who builds on the site of Yericho is going to be punished. So Achav, the Medrash says that Achav and Eliyahu both showed up to give Nechama, and Achav said to the person, said, you know, if you are punished, I don't really believe in punishment because I worship idols. And if there's really a God, he should punish me. Eliyahu said, oh, if there's a God, you're not going to have rain. You're not going to have rain for 3 years. And lo and behold, there was no rain. There was no rain for 3 years. Eliyahu came out of nowhere. We made no significant effort to talk about who exactly was the Navi before Eliyahu and how did that Navi train Eliyahu? How was it given over to Eliyahu? That's absent. Why that is, I don't have an answer to. It's a good question. You could do the research. But this parak is about that we do have a transition. It's almost reminiscent of Sefer Shmuel, where we had a real transition from Eli to Shmuel, or the end of the Torah, where we have a clear act of transition from Moshe to Yehoshua. And it's actually going to be, we're going to see there are a number of similarities, some which we've pointed out before, and some which we'll see from this parak, that actually similarities between Moshe Rabbeinu and Eliyahu. And the fact that each of them seem to be guiding, or at least acting as the giver in this transition to the next leader of the Jewish people. Spiritual is not here. We're not talking about a king. Moshe and Yehoshua were. It wasn't just spiritual leader. Then it was the combined spiritual, political, king-like leader. But there's something, and so while obviously the lights and whistles of this perek is Eliyahu going up in this whirlwind to the heaven. But that's Vayihi. It was in the midst of that something else is taking place. What is taking place? The end of the pasuk after the Asnachta. Vayelech Eliyahu ve'Elisha mina Gilgal. That Eliyahu and Elisha went from Gilgal. The Mefarshim explain what are they doing in Gilgal. What's happening? So the Mefarshim explain, and again, we're not always told everything that happens. Eliyahu was told advanced warning by Hashem that his life as he knows it is coming to an end. and his life is going to come to an end in some miraculous fashion. Whether or not he knows the exact elements of that miracle, we don't know. So Eliyahu in his mind knows that he needs to leave this world, and it needs to happen in a miraculous fashion. So where do you go to make a miracle happen? You should go to a place of significance. Maybe miracles happened there before, or other things, other significant things happened there before, and so that might be the location. And it could be Hashem didn't tell him exactly where to go, but it was kind of that he would find, either he would find it on his own, Hashem would point him in a direction. And so they went to Gilgal. Gilgal was the first place that they went to. Why was Gilgal significant? So Gilgal was when they came, when Yehoshua led the people in to Eretz Yisrael, Gilgal was the first place that they arrived. The first place where they set up camp in Eretz Yisrael was in Gilgal, and that's where HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded that stones be taken from the other side of the Jordan, be placed in Eretz Yisrael. That was in Gilgal. Gilgal was where Shmuel brought everyone to accept Shaul as the king. Gilgal was a place of significance. And so Elisha and Eliyahu went to Gilgal in order to bring about this miraculous, lack of a better word, at this point it seems to be a death, of Eliyahu. The immediate question, and we could try to discuss it a little bit now, is what does this heading mean? That Eliyahu is going to go up in a whirlwind to heaven. We know, and we're very familiar, that Eliyahu is very busy. He goes to every single bris, but a lot of brises. I know that the day my first son had his bris, the mohel that I had did 7 brises that day. That's just that mohel. How many brises? It's a lot of brises. Then he also, Seder night, he's very busy. Second Seder, it's only outside of Eretz Yisrael, so it's a little less. But the first night, he's got to do both. And then you read through the Gemara and you read through Midrashim. He's always meeting Amor. He's meeting this person. He's bumping into that person. You know, the Hasidic stories where this place didn't have a minion. All of a sudden, Eliyahu. And we know the final idea of Eliyahu is that Eliyahu is, he's the Mavaser Tov. He's the, as the Navi describes, he's the announcer of good. He's going to herald the coming of the Mashiach. That Eliyahu HaNavi is going to come and announce Mashiach. So how do you do that if you die on the other side? And again, it sounds simplistic. The other side is, how do you take a physical body and go up to Shemayim? It's not a physical place. There is no physicality. So the Mefarshim here deal with it. And the Radak takes the approach that we're going to see that this whirlwind, this Sa'ara, involves fire, and that as he was going up in this it's going to be a rechev, a chariot of fire. The fire burnt his clothing, burnt his body, and he went up to Shemayim a neshama. He went up to Shemayim as a neshama, and how do you go ahead and deal with the fact that he can do human-like things? So the Radak explains that Hashem gives him another body, that he sends the neshama down in another body when he has a mission to go ahead and do. There are other mefarshim, the Ralbag explains that there are other times in Tanakh where the word Shamayim doesn't necessarily mean Shamayim. That when Klal Yisrael build the Tower of Bavel, it's described as Shamayim. They didn't make it all the way to Shamayim. They made it to a high location relative to the ground. And so the Ralbag explains that Eliyahu was just taken to another location and lives in that other location in solitude. And then he never dies. He actually never dies. And if he never dies, well, then he can be a human. Again, The fact that he never dies, if you have a problem with that, then how exactly are you going to have a fiery chariot taking off to the Shemayim? So if you can't believe in miracles, then this is not for you. And I don't know, you know, we're people that we believe in miracles. That's we believe a sea split, and we believe that a man went onto an ark with all the animals in the world and lived on a boat for a year. If you can't believe that, then you know, you got to work on your emuna. So if he can go up in a fiery chariot, he can be taken to an off location, and he can still be alive. He can still be alive, and he still plays a role. And I personally sleep better believing that he's going to come and herald the Mashiach than believing anything else. And we have Psukim. The Psukim in Navi talk about the Psukim in the last Psukim of all of Navi, the Sefer Malachi, ends with Hine Yom Ba, that this day is going to come, that Eliyahu is going to Heshav Levavos Albanim Levavos. It mentions him by name, that he's going to bring the fine, he's going to help bring the final redemption. Right, so that's getting a little, again, you know, I don't know how that developed. The truth of the matter is, it does deserve a little bit of research. It obviously, you know, with my children, I always try. Oh, you missed him. You didn't look quick enough. But yeah, you shake the table. You give a little nudge on the table. Okay. These things are cute for kids. You know, the fact that the bris. So we had mentioned that because Eliyahu was so he was so tough against Klal Yisrael, that as a punishment, he had to show up at every single bris as a way of saying that Hashem says, look, my children, they do keep bris because Eliyahu had said something to Hashem about that they break your covenant. And Eliyahu said, and Hashem in this medrash responds back to Eliyahu, you're right, it's my covenant, it's not yours. And so I can be harsh, you can't be harsh. And so he makes him go to the bris to rub it in that Klal Yisrael still look, it's 2015 and the Jewish people are still keeping bris milah. But the idea that he's going to bring the Mashiach, so that seems to involve a human body. And all these stories that take place in the Gemara about Amoraim and Tanaim coming in contact with him, it seems to be it's a human interaction. So the Ralbag understands that he was still human. You know, depending on what you're going to which explanation or something in between that's going to sit better with you. Okay, I think you know it's all okay. The Gemara tells us that one of the things that Eliyahu does is he answers questions. He's going to answer questions. And so the Gemara has this acronym called Teku. That when the Gemara gets to a question, once in a while the Gemara comes to a question, doesn't have a clear answer. The Gemara just says, you know, it's like playing a get-a-jail-free card. Teku, and you can go, now you go to the next topic. Teku, we don't know. Teku means Tishbi, Yitaretz, Kushios, V'ubayos. The Tishbi. Eliyahu HaTishbi will come and Yitaretz. He will answer all the kushyas. He'll answer the questions, the ubayas, the problems. So there is this concept that Eliyahu is going to actually exist or still exists as a person, and that's this episode here. It raises the questions because he doesn't actually die a normal death. He doesn't die a death wherein he's then buried. You know, we have many prominent individuals who die, and the Tanakh tells us that they die, tells us that they're buried, tells us where they're buried. The kings are always buried with their forefathers, and Shmuel was buried where he was. We're told these things, and here we're not told. It's reminiscent of the pasuk in Sefer Bereishis. It says about Chanoch, the Chanoch, who was, I think he was the son of Enoch. He was like fourth or fifth generation from Adam, and it says that he like just walked with God. It does, and everyone else in the Perek lives a whole amount of years and dies, and he's the only one who doesn't die. says that he just walked. So it is, it's a question that the Mefarshim deal with there. So that when you don't tell us that he dies, so that leads us to these conclusions. The Gemara, I'll close with the words of the Gemara. We'll come back to the words of the Gemara. The Gemara gets into the question. We're going to see that after it actually happens, Elisha tears kriya at the death of Eliyahu. And the Gemara learns halachos, that you and I, unfortunately, in those times, halachos of kriya that are applicable to us nowadays, we learn from this episode of Elisha and Eliyahu. And so if you're tearing kriya, when do you tear kriya? When someone passes away. So Reish Lakish comes up with the question that many of us could come up with, Eliyahu chayhu! Eliyahu's alive! How could you tear kriya for someone that's alive? So Rabbi Yochanan answered him back, Kevan dechsiv velo ra'u od, the Pasuk mentions, and we'll read it next time, that he could no longer see him. From his perspective, from this perspective of Elisha, Eliyahu was gone, and that was enough of a consideration that he could then be halachically warranted to tear kriya. Normally, tearing kriya, you're not allowed to tear kriya. Tearing kriya is bal tashkas. You're not allowed to tear kriya. It's only in response to loss that we're mandated to tear kriya to show that our world has been torn and have that manifested. So the here you have on the one hand it seems that the Chazal, Reish Lakish, and Rabbi Yochanan, they're being sensitive to the fact that he didn't die. That's our main tradition, right? Reish Lakish just said, but he's alive. Reish Lakish says he's alive. This is talking about 400 CE. If we're in 2015 and 400, Reish Lakish is telling Rabbi Yochanan, but he's alive. That, from his perspective, he was no longer there. And we're going to see the other individuals who were around when this happened, they went looking for Eliyahu. They didn't know how to process this. And so this is what we have in the Tanakh. And then the statements of Chazal kind of are dealing with this idea that Eliyahu, it definitely wasn't the norm. And again, so the Radak says that it's just it was an elaborate way of his neshama going up to Shemayim. You know, you have to, I hope I'm allowed to ask this question. It means that his body got burned. Why didn't it get buried? We usually, kvura is a huge halacha, that we kavor tikbarenu bayomu. The pasuk talks about the idea of burying. The psukim talk about the idea of burying. Avram and Sarah, Mar Samach Pela, the whole aspect of kvura is such a big concept. How could there be no kvura here? I haven't seen anyone talk about that. So Moshe Rabbeinu, so the Torah says that Hashem buried him. The Torah, the Gemara in Maseches Sota, I believe, talks about how the Torah begins with an act of chesed and ends with an act of chesed. It begins with Hashem giving clothing to Adam, and it ends with Hashem burying Moshe Rabbeinu. So, you know, so he had a burial, just wasn't a popular burial in front of a lot of people. That's a question I haven't seen anyone ask it. But it's something for us to think about. The Ralbag takes the approach slightly more, I guess, I don't know if it's slightly more miraculous. This whole thing is miraculous. That he still is actually alive. And he was just kept in a solitude location. And we're going to see, there seems to be a very big difference between the prophecy of Eliyahu and the leadership of Eliyahu versus the leadership of Elisha. The Eliyahu was much more of a lone individual, while Elisha was much more of a man of the people. And that might even be another similarity to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was removed. His tent was removed. He separated himself from his wife. And, you know, that was different than Miriam and I. He was different. Moshe Rabbeinu was separated, and it could be Eliyahu in his own way was separated. So Be'ez Hashem, next time, we'll pick up with getting into this Perek Beis, this real story of the final act of life of Eliyahu and the transition to Elisha.